research regarding our brains is creating a renaissance whose boundaries are both dissolving the scientific brain research from the past 400 years and creating, rather than establishing, possibilities that enhance individual physical and consciousness growth. Dr. Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself, written for the public, shares information usually only read by those scanning medical and scientific journals. We continue with Norman today. I promise you'll be inspired. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries.
It's probably best to give an example and so people can understand what we're talking about in a concrete way.
Thank you.
So I'll give you one, a dramatic one. Michael Bernstein was an eye surgeon, and in his mid-50s, he was an eye surgeon, a tennis buff, he played piano, and in his mid-50s, while on the tennis court, he had a devastating stroke, and one entire side of his body was paralyzed. He happened to be living in Birmingham, Alabama, and he got the conventional treatment, which was about 6 weeks. At the end of it, he had hardly any improvement, and was sent home and said, you know, this is it. You know, you can try a little stuff on your own, but this is basically where you're going to be. Now, in Birmingham, Alabama, Dr. Edward Taub,
hero,
was working, and Dr. Taub, originally doing work with monkeys, had made some very remarkable discoveries. He basically discovered that when an animal has the equivalent of a stroke, it tries to use the affected arm, the arm that's not working, on a number of occasions, and it doesn't work. The animal finds it, the arm doesn't work, so it starts to use its other arm instead. And he called this learned non-use, but he discovered almost by accident that if he took the animal's good arm and put it in a sling so it couldn't use it, and then trained the animal's weakened arm, he could actually get it working. So when Dr. Bernstein came for his treatment, they put a sling on one of his arms, and then they incrementally trained his weakened arm. And they got him to do very functional activities. And Dr. Bernstein said he could almost feel his arm coming back, you know, every few minutes of this incremental, exhausting exercise. And the entire treatment took only 2 solid weeks. But, you know, during the course of those weeks, he could never use his good arm. We now have brain scan studies that show that, in fact, with this treatment, what is happening is cells that are adjacent to the injury start, that were not devoted to, you know, moving the arm, start to take over and learn how to process that movement. And sometimes cells in the opposite hemisphere do the same thing. So by the end of his treatment, Dr. Bernstein, who was, you know, basically doing microscopic kinds of interventions inside an eye, was back, using both of his hands and basically fully back in practice. And many people who have undergone this intervention have gone from having, strokes which have made them completely dependent on others to being able to be independent. Dr. Taub has primarily worked on rehabilitation of movement problems, that's arms and legs. In Germany, they took his work and they applied it to language and have helped people begin to speak again. So this is an intervention that basically reorganizes the brain and builds up new processors. And Dr. Taub, and once, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't matter when you had your stroke. Dr. Taub, in the book, I describe a man who had a stroke 50 years.
Yes, that's,
before he went to Dr. Taub's.
That's
key. He was
key.
A little boy playing baseball. And so, and it also works for movement problems that stem from other neurological conditions. I can't say all neurological conditions, but so far we know that people who have had, for instance, radiation to the brain, which has damaged certain parts of the brain, have benefited. He's worked a lot with children who've had cerebral palsy, and they've benefited, and they've had benefits for people with multiple sclerosis. So this is a core kind of intervention, and what it illustrates is the role of a block, if you will. Now, let me say why the block is important. We have learned that when you train neurons and the circuits grow neuroplastically, these circuits are competitive. They work faster than the other untrained neurons. They give off sharper, stronger signals. And so whenever you've trained to do something, it will compete with other circuits in your brain for cortical real estate. Think of a kid in who goes to grade school in grade one and answers the one of the first questions the teacher asks, and she builds up her confidence. And so the next time the teacher asks a question, her hand is first up, and she builds up her confidence even more. And the next thing you know, she's the keener in the class whose hand is always up with the first answer, if you will. Something like that happens in the brain. So now back to a person who's had stroke. If the person had a stroke and they can't use their right arm, they start to use their left arm, and it's always the first circuit to fire whenever you want to do something. And if you go with that, each time you do, you'll reinforce the advantage of the good arm over the weak arm. And that weak arm will never, ever have any improvement. So you need a sling or a cast or something to block the good arm, to force you to use the weakened arm. But this kind of intervention works in many ways. And in the book, I describe a very wonderful neuroplastic intervention for OCD. Now, in OCD, we now know that there is a worry circuit. The worry circuit is in all of us, those with or without OCD.
And we should mention that OCD is obsessive-compulsive
disorder.
Yes.
And so just think about yourself at a party or at dinner tonight, and you spill some wine on your shirt or blouse, and what you experience. The first thing is you detect the error. You have an error detection mechanism in your brain, in the orbital frontal cortex just behind your eyes. But you also feel anxious or a little upset or a sense of urgency. And that's because the orbital frontal cortex shoots a signal up to something called the cingulate, which makes you anxious. And this sense, I've made a mistake, and a kind of anxiousness about it is what Jeffrey Schwartz has called the mistake feeling, beautifully named. So we all have the mistake feeling every day. And then in normal circumstances, you correct that mistake, so you get your OxyClean out or you wash your blouse, and the mistake feeling goes away. The anxiety kept you focused on it until you corrected it, but an action takes it away. And that happens because there's a third part of the brain called the caudate nucleus, which is like a mental gear shift. It changes the page, the mental page in the brain, so that when you're finished dealing with one thing, you can go on to the next. And in people with OCD, that caudate gets stuck. That gear shift is very sticky. And the only way to change it, Dr. Schwartz discovered, is to kind of go in manually with mental effort and change it. Now, there are a variety of treatments for OCD, and they all work, but when you look at the studies of them, none of them work brilliantly. None of them work for everybody. Some of them lower the OCD somewhat. But, you know, we have a long way to go. And what Schwartz realized is that all of the existing treatments, you know, all of which have some place, all work by getting the person to think about the obsession or the compulsion a bit more. So, for instance, you know, the behaviorists, if you have a certain kind of, let's say you have a, you're obsessed with, doing something or very germophobic and you compulsively avoid every time you go to the bathroom, you wash your hands 7 times and then you wash them again because, the mistake feeling is not going away and you're afraid of germs, they might take you into a bathroom and get you to clean toilets or worse. Now, that basically involves getting you to think about or sense and perceive germs even more. The psychoanalytic approaches, and I'm an unapologetic psychoanalyst, but what we would do is we would get people to analyze, why germs? When did it start? How, what might they symbolize? And certainly in young people and in milder cases, the psychoanalytic approaches are, can be helpful, just as in some cases the behavioral approaches can be helpful in getting rid of the phobia, or rather the compulsions, or et cetera. But in extreme cases, it doesn't seem to work very well. That's pretty
right. It's a matter, in a way, of hocus-pocus. It's all where you focus.
Well, I don't know if it's hocus-pocus, but it is where you focus. And they are getting them to, I'm not familiar with that idiom, but they are, the analysts are also getting the person to think about it, which means in some ways reinforcing the circuit. And
exactly.
The cognitive behaviorists do the same thing. They get you to do a list of what's irrational about your phophobia. But of course, your compulsion or your obsession, but people already know that in most cases.
Exactly.
So what Schwartz realized is what you have to focus on, or what you can focus on, is not just the content of the compulsion, but just the form of the illness. And so what he would do is he would get his patients in step one just to say, look, I've got a problem right now, but it's not germs. It's my OCD that's acting up. That would be the first thing. And then, rather than getting them to analyze it or expose themselves to germs or think about what's wrong with their ideas, he would just get them to change the channel and think of something else, which is basically manually shifting that gear shift. What you have to do the second you recognize it's an OCD intervention, an OCD problem, is to actually kind of manually shift the gear shift by using mental concentration to shift and focus on another act that is doing something wholesome. And the very act of trying to shift starts to build up neuronal connections in the caudate to take it from being a kind of manual gear shift to a more automatic gear shift. And he's had some very, very good results. And that was some of his patients, and he's done studies which show that if you take his patients, you look at their brain scans before the treatment, that circuit is lighting up. It's not moving. And by the end of the treatment, their worry circuit's restored to normal. And so that's a great neuroplastic intervention.
Yes, it's quite brilliant.
It's called Brain Lock, by the way.
Yes. As you mention in your book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and as you mentioned today, all of the things in your book are just so, they're very insightful. They're life-changing. They are, nothing short of miraculous, really. And as you brought up in our talk today, which is important, I think, is that it takes a lot of time and energy, and a lot of people have suffered quite a bit and made effort to really make these shifts. And it's certainly something that none of this can be taken very lightly. It's reading about it, in a sense, makes it seem like, wow, that's great. You can just go do this.
Well, you can. I mean, the reason I emphasize that it's often hard work is because sometimes people, are hearing about neuroplasticity and trying to, map it onto some kind of extremely new age-like wishful thinking. And I don't believe it is wishful thinking. I don't think this is not, anything's possible. Maybe one day people will speed up neuroplasticity. I think that that probably will happen. But, you know, we're not talking about anything magical here. The people who've been able to recover from strokes, you know, have had to use a lot of mental effort. So I wanted to emphasize that. No, there are certain things in my book where people have recoveries that are much, much faster, and I would say not painful. It's just a matter of giving the brain the right information, and I describe that for, you know, pain treatments and other treatments. Look, there is a famous neuroplastic experiment done by Alvaro Pasqualoni. And, you know, how people interpret that is very important. He took people who had never played the piano before and divided them into two groups. And the first group, he taught to read a kind of elementary musical notation. And they were given practice sessions of about an hour, 5 days a week. And he mapped their brains using something called transcranial magnetic stimulation at the beginning of the experiment and at the end, and I think at the beginning of each day and at the end of each day. And then there was another group called the mental practice group. So they were, you know, they got to listen to the melody, as did the first group, and they were asked just to imagine playing the right keys, but they didn't touch the keys like the physical practice group did. And at the end of the week, both groups had improved significantly. The physical practice group a bit more than the mental practice group, but with, I think it was about an hour session of practice, the mental practice group had actually caught up to the physical practice group. And on the brain maps, what Pasqualoni showed was that the same brain areas had developed and changed in both groups. So what this shows is that mental rehearsal, or you might call it imagining, actually changes brain structure. Now, there are many, many such versions of this experiment that have been done since, but this is the first, you know, in some ways the most important one. So, that makes a lot of sense. It shows, you know, when athletes, for instance, spend a lot of time, divers, imagine how they're going to flip over the board and twist and turn and do mental rehearsal. But that makes sense. Glenn Gould, the Canadian pianist, after a certain point, did most of his practice in his head, just imagining doing it. But this is doing mental work on, you know, various circuits, which are then going to be used. This does not mean that if I spent a lot of time just imagining that I would win, a major prize as a musician, and wish, you know, imagine going up to the podium and accept it, that I'm going to become I'm going to win that prize.
Well, I think
they were doing very specific interventions.
Exactly, and I think that's part of the problem, as you mentioned earlier, with the whole self-help movement. You know, people think they'll read the book and it's going to change something for them. The part that ends up missing in that is they're not really doing the work, taking the time to make the change happen in the brain.
Now, in the book, I describe many kinds of interventions that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about.
It's a must-read, by the way.
For learning disabilities, for preserving the aging brain, for balance problems, and so on and so forth, where groups have put together brain exercises, which they've developed in some cases over the course of over 30 years now, which have, you know, real documented changes. Learning disorders are one of the areas that's most radically affected by these new neuroplastic developments.
Yes, the work is just brilliant, and it's so exciting for children.
And so I'm very, very optimistic that we can change and improve our treatment of kids with learning disabilities. I've seen it with my own eyes, and I described multiple cases there. Basically, you know, we've discovered that, you know, everybody varies in terms of their skills and their deficits, and many of the learning disabilities, many of the reading disabilities involve, for instance, just one small area of the brain It varies from person to person. That's weak, where there's a kind of roadblock in the brain, so that all the relevant areas are working except one, and then that child is not able to read. And if you can figure out what that area is and target it with the right kind of exercise, they can get reading or learn math or learn to overcome their nonverbal learning problems.
And they're able to do this with video games or...
There are a number of interventions, and one of them includes video games, some very fine video games developed by Scientific Learning for a particular kind of reading problem in which the person has difficulty with auditory processing of the fast sounds of speech. It's very common. It's not the only cause of reading problems, but if your child or you or someone you care about has auditory processing problems, that's one of the things to look at. And over a million kids have had that intervention, and there have been good studies showing that it works for many people, and their brains start processing things differently before and after these exercises, which go on for about 6 to 8 weeks, an hour a day, something like that.
Do you know how widespread this technology is being used or is known about? I mean, I feel like this should be part and parcel with every education system for teachers, for instance.
Well, so do I, but, it's just beginning.
Not yet.
The ones that are done on computers that can be widely distributed are done by more people, but this is as I said at the beginning, revolutions take time to unfold. I mean, the discovery of electricity and electromagnetism and the use of it, in the 1800s, pretty much, is still giving rise to new inventions every single day in different sectors. And the discovery of brain plasticity is something that's on par with that. It's going to take many years for us to fully benefit from it. But as I argue in the book, every child would do well to have a brain-based assessment. And that, by the way, does not mean that they have to have their brain scanned necessarily, but certain brain functions assessed, in grades 1 and 2, while their brains are especially plastic, and some exercises developed so that when you go to school, you not only learn important information and skills that you can do without training, but you can actually train your brain if you have a weakened area to, in some respects, you could fairly say, become smarter and process things that you can't. And there are many, many examples in the book of the kinds of learning disorders that can be treated, and I continue to work on new discoveries, and in my next book, which I'm just beginning, there'll be more.
Bravo. The sport of cycling and other sports are constantly fraught with doping allegations, and in your book you mention neuronal chips, and I'm wondering if that would eventually take the place of drugs.
Well, anything's possible. I just don't know. It's possible. I haven't seen evidence of that yet.
What use are they using the neuronal chips for now?
Well, I mean, the initial experiments I described involved... neuroplasticity means mental experience changes brain structure and function, which means... when you have an idea, it leads to a kind of signature of, in the sort of material physical world, of neuronal firing. And work done in the United States showed that if you took an array, which is just like a flat plate with lots of little microelectrodes on it, and you put it over a monkey's brain, and then you got the monkey to move its arm, a computer over time could read the firing patterns of the monkey moving its arm through those microelectrodes. And so you had a kind of translation device And after a while, they could feed that information of the monkey, what the firing pattern of the monkey moving its arm, into a computer, which then fed that information into an artificial arm. So they then taught the monkey to move the artificial arm without moving its own arm, just by thinking the pattern it thought when it moved its own arm. So this is a kind of thought translation device. And recently in human beings who have been completely paralyzed, they've put these microelectrode arrays on a person and got them to imagine moving their completely paralyzed arm on a computer keyboard, and basically trained the computer to recognize what their brain is like when it's firing, you know, move the mouse up, move the mouse down. And after a certain amount of training, they hooked that, they fed that information into a mechanical arm so that the person could basically use their thoughts alone to move the mechanical arm to open and close their computer, that kind of thing. So there are, you know, there are illnesses like ALS and a lot of illnesses where people are completely paralyzed, where they can now, with this attachment on their brain, basically, I'm not sure they're sending their thoughts, but they're creating patterns which can be read by machines to perform actions. And it's, you know, it's very sci-fi. You know, imagine this person sitting in a wheelchair, just thinking, you know, turn computer on, open email, list, send email to Robin Clare, you know what I mean, or whatever.
Yes.
And then type A, C, D, L, M, etc.
2 weeks with Dr. Norman Doidge, author of The Brain That Changes Itself, barely scratches the surface of the information contained in his book. For inspiration on many levels, I can't recommend it highly enough. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly notice of shows, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.